Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. If you like the show, let people know. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be speaking to a lightning expert about what happens when 100 million volts pass through your body. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of your comments at the end of the pod. First, though, it's time to look back at the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway and science communicator Owen Murphy. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
It's got to be something else.
Lupus could cause...
No, lupus progresses slower. There'd be joint pain.
So it's not a typical case. We should get an ANA.
It's not lupus.
Has to do with lupus, Jess.
That's right. And a possible new cure for lupus, or at least a new treatment that can reduce its symptoms really dramatically using immunotherapy. So lupus, if you're not familiar, is this chronic autoimmune disease. It affects about 5 million people worldwide. And it's a really nasty piece of work. Like, it's where your immune system basically attacks healthy tissue, which can result in lots of inflammation, fatigue, but also like damage to your internal organs, like your kidneys, your lungs, your heart. It's a really, really... a bad disease and a disease that's quite hard to treat as well. Because if you think about, you know, for very severe cases of lupus, how could you reduce the sort of immune activity in your body? If you reduce the thing that is causing lupus, you then also reduce your immune system and its ability to respond to other stuff. So it's been a really persistent and difficult disease to treat for a long time. But this new kind of therapy that was trialed in a study by University College London and the NHS in the UK actually found incredibly good response using this new immunotherapy. So it's a type of therapy that's actually already been used to treat different types of blood cancers. And basically what they do is they take your T cells, so these immune cells in the body, they take some of them out and they teach them how to identify some of the like rogue B cells or the rogue immune cells that are causing the lupus itself.
Yeah.
They take them out, they sort of reprogram them, they put them back in. And one thing that's amazing about this treatment is that it's a one-time treatment. It's not like a medication that you have to take. It's not an ongoing thing. It is a one-time reinfusion of these modified T cells. It's called CAR T cell therapy. So the CAR is chimeric antigen receptors, which is the type of change that they're providing to the T cells.
Mm.
But basically what they found is actually really, really good remission rates in the patients that have been treated with these modified T cells. And again, it's sort of their own body cells that are being taught how to not do the thing that they were doing when you had lupus. And the number of people in this trial was quite small. But initially, the patients that they treated with a lower dose had very, very good response. Most of them were able to just go off of their lupus medications entirely.
Wow.
They're now doing a secondary trial with a higher dose to see, does that act faster? Is it still safe? And the next step, of course, is larger trials, because there have been a few small trials of this type of treatment for lupus over the last, like, 10 years or so. They're very, very promising. But for it to be a commercially available treatment, you have to make sure that it's safe and that it works for everybody.
These therapies can be very expensive, and governments then, you know, are often quite slow to say, yeah, sure, no problems, and sign off on them. I think, you know, the mood is shifting a little bit, because some of these would be €1 million for a treatment, right? It's a huge amount of money for a single patient. But if you cure someone from a disease that has them in hospital all the time, and hospital stays, we know, are very, very, you bring that person back to work, they don't need carers around them, they provide taxes. The benefit of curing one person, particularly a person in their, I hate to say it, but someone who is young or in their earlier years rather than 80s or 90s.
And that's when people get diagnosed with lupus.
Yeah, the benefit is, to me, far outweighs it, apart from it being, you know, a moral obligation. I think if we have the ability to cure these people, these diseases, we should. So really, really exciting to hear that. And it's great when we get a twofer, because CAR-T is amazing. There's some great work in James's delivering CAR-T to patients, and amazing that we might use this for other autoimmune. So I love that story. Second story, Owen, we've got to stop hugging trees.
Yeah. I mean, look, the idea that we know how important it is that we pull carbon from the atmosphere, we sequester it, and trees are a massive carbon sink, a huge part to play in that. And it had been thought that photosynthesis essentially equated to wood growth. Now, a big study coming out of the US based on the East and the West Coast and looking at 137 different sites has found that this isn't always the case. So photosynthesis fundamentally is that we can pull in the carbon dioxide, soak up the water, mix it together in the presence of the sun's energy, produce oxygen and produce sugars and glucose. Now, when that happens in a tree, those sugars become the building blocks for the wood. On the east coast of the States, where it's a little bit colder, spring kicks in and they get about 7 months of growing. On the west coast, it's warmer, about 10 months. Now, what they've found in the US is that before we thought that when photosynthesis occurred during this season, the trees also grew. But things are getting hotter. Things are getting hotter all around the world. The air is getting drier. And trees, although they like the warmth in the spring, if it gets too hot, they stop growing.
And they stop sequestering carbon.
Absolutely. Okay, so the figures we have here is that in the eastern US, they saw that after the trees had stopped growing, 36%, there was still more, 36% time left or a period where they were photosynthesizing.
Right.
Okay, and on the West Coast then, it was 26%.
So the lungs of the planet that we really need to reduce the carbon dioxide from our atmosphere, we potentially have overestimated their ability to do this for us by nearly a third in some cases?
By a huge degree, by a huge degree. And when we work on these Earth system models, where we pull in the physical, biological, chemical data, bring it together and look to see what that means for climate and weather patterns, we use these models.
Mm.
But what it means is that a lot of the carbon we thought were being sequestered and built up to grow into wood in the trees may be finding its way into other parts of the plants or the trees, which aren't going to be sequestered for as long and can find their way back into the atmosphere much quicker.
And of course, this sounds like a looped system, because as the temperature rises, because enough carbon dioxide is not being absorbed, that number of 36% presumably goes higher.
I think it's tragic, because essentially the parts of the natural system which we thought we could use to help heal the planet are actually so badly damaged that they can't even work as they should anymore.
In terms of this particular study, how representative do we think it is of trees generally? So, for example, you know, we tend to think of the Amazon as being, you know, that major part of the world that is doing a lot of the carbon dioxide sequestering.
So this study focused on oak trees, just oak trees.
Right.
But I guess the thing about oak trees are they're often seen as the great trees.
They last a very long time as well. Okay, I think that is something to think about.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Owen. Our third story, Jess, has to do with aliens.
That's right. If things are bad on our planet, just look to other planets.
No. Throw something at her.
Oh, no. Okay, this is my car now. This is a new study, actually, from SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute in the U.S., who have been for decades looking at different signals from the universe as a whole, looking for extraterrestrial life. Famously, so far, have not found any. But this new study talks about maybe why that is. So the way that SETI and other projects look for extraterrestrial life is by looking for these very narrow band radio transmissions that can propagate a really long way through the universe, but that cannot be produced by any sort of existing natural, cosmic, or astrophysical processes that we know about.
Yeah.
And these are things, you know, that our civilization has been making for like 100 years or so now. But basically the idea is if the band of radio emission is really, really narrow, then that couldn't have come from any sort of star eating another star or something. It has to have come from an advanced civilization. And we have not seen any of that yet.
Right.
So this new study actually proposes a reason why, which is that when people look at these signals that have been, presumably, if they did exist, they would have been transmitted over large swaths of the universe, there has been a compensation for distortion that can come from that long transmission. But no one had previously looked at, within a solar system, if those radio bands are being emitted, how could they be distorted or changed? And it turns out that actually space weather, you know, the stuff that is coming from the sun, like these sort of plasma ejections, any sort of really strong solar winds or different types of space weather that, you know, we are very used to seeing, and seeing how that interacts with things like satellites here in our solar system, that would change the type of signals that SETI has been looking for as well. And it would make them more broad in the radio frequency spectrum, which means that SETI might not have been able to detect them.
Right.
So a
narrow band becomes broader because it's sort of almost put through the lens of a solar wind that's created from ejections of material and energy from a sun, for example.
Exactly. And one of the issues, now that we know that this is true, is they found that actually there would be really strong effects from what are called M-type dwarf stars, which is 75% of the stars in the Milky Way are that kind of star. So lots of places that we might be looking for extraterrestrial life, we would see that kind of distortion and thus would not be able to pick up the sort of fingerprint in radio frequencies that we've been looking for.
And presumably that means that aliens looking for us wouldn't have found us either, unless they thought of that.
Well, to me, the thing that's always interesting about this kind of like looking for these narrow frequency radio bands is, like, that presumes that all technological development would follow the same path that we've followed, which isn't necessarily true.
No, but it is. But I mean, we are bounded by the physical world.
We are bounded by the physical world.
And energy is a universal thing, as far as we're aware. So, I mean, it makes sense in a way, but I guess not knowing what you don't know is always the problem.
That's just it. But we're looking for the fingerprint of a civilization like ours. We haven't found it yet. And this kind of indicates one reason why. So this will change the way that these kind of signal search processes are done in the future.
Yeah.
But there still could be lots of signals that we're not seeing.
Yeah, with Frank Drake's equation saying that, you know, the chances of us being alone in the universe are infinitesimal, but then whose paradox is it?
The Fermi paradox.
Fermi paradox is like, where the hell are they?
And yeah, I guess that's where a good are question. They? And are they hiding because we live in a grim and horrible universe where everyone has to hide?
Would you want to meet us, knowing what you know?
Give me another 10 years. We'll see.
All right. Our final story, Owen, has to do with goats.
Yeah, this is a good one, Jonathan. I suppose it's looking at the level of communication possible between animals and humans. And we're all familiar with the idea of dolphins, dogs, the great apes, even horses and goats in certain circumstances can follow the vocal cues and hand signals of humans. But this is novel in
so
that...
So what do you mean? Like that we know that if you point somewhere, a dog will follow your finger and know where you go?
Yeah, yeah. Or if I say a word, it can be trained to learn what that word means as a command.
Right.
What's novel about this is, and this isn't something I've thought about before, what about I'm speaking in a specific direction?
Yeah.
Can it detect that direction and use that to follow an instruction? So I'm going to give you an example of speaking about car keys here today.
Yeah.
If you lost your car keys and I found them, I said, Jonathan, I have them here. The first thing you'd probably do is look to see where I'm standing.
Yeah.
If you still couldn't see it and I say, look, they're over here, Jonathan, you'd look to see which direction I'm pointing.
Yes.
But what if I was obscured and you couldn't see where I was?
Well, then I wouldn't know where you were pointing.
Well, that's what I would have thought. However, research has been conducted previously on infants and puppies, young dogs, that showed that by speaking excitedly in the direction of a treat bucket, when the researcher was obscured, the animals and the infants moved towards that.
Ah, so it was like, they even if they couldn't see you, they knew that you were pointing or your face was pointing a certain... Okay, all right.
So what they did here was they did the exact same study with 29 goats. Okay, now, why go?
Do you know, we often talk about basic research or, you know, like, you know, we learn the strangest things from just asking interesting questions. This is a good one. Okay, go ahead.
So why goats? Well, okay, let's rationalize this one. Goats are one of the oldest domesticated animals we have. Uh-huh. About 10,500 years ago, we domesticated goats. So in this study, they used 29 domesticated goats, put them in a pen. They had a wooden screen in the middle of it. High enough and wide enough to cover the researcher. Two red buckets either side. One red bucket had a treat, uncooked pasta, it's a treat for goats apparently, and nothing in the other one. Three scenarios. The researcher stood behind the wooden screen, closer to the empty bucket, but still obscured by the screen, and spoke excitedly towards the treat bucket.
Right.
Second scenario, it didn't say anything. The researcher said nothing, and the second researcher just released the goat. Third scenario, it turned its back to the wooden screen and spoke away, so not towards either of the buckets.
Mm-hmm.
60% of the time in the first scenario, when the researcher spoke excitedly towards the treat bucket, it went to that bucket.
Hmm.
47 and 49% in the other scenarios. So
right,
it just looks
so
like
random.
Chance,
yeah,
random.
Yeah.
So why is this important?
Yeah.
So why is this important?
You know?
Well, I mean,
is that the end?
No. You know, the reason they say is that it actually shows us that there's a lot more similarities between human and animal communication than we might recognize at times. You
know,
so there's a lot more going on there. Maybe it'll help us understand how they see the world. Apart from dogs, it's possible that goats may be the greatest of all time.
Oh, very good.
At following human cues.
Very good, very good. Before we go, Jess, you have something coming up. I guess it's going to involve humor and dancing.
It's going to involve dancing and science.
Okay.
So this is a project that has a public show next week on the 24th of June called Rooted in the River, which is a dance theater, but also like spoken word and scientific exploration of the Corrib River in Galway. So it's out at the University of Galway.
It's the scientific exploration of the Corrib River through dance.
Exactly.
Awesome.
So it'll be looking at the biodiversity, the way that humans interact with the river. So, you know, things like fishing and pollution, but also like good things that we do in the river and the way that we enjoy it as part of our lives. But also how, of course, the river is changing as part of climate change, but also our increased protection of it.
Something different. That's happening next Wednesday, 24th of June.
Wednesday, the 24th of June.
And how do people find out more?
On Eventbrite. Tickets are free because we have the wonderful support of Research Ireland.
All right. Well, Jasmine Fairfield, thank you very much. Owen Murphy, thank you too. On the way, what happens when you get struck by lightning? Welcome back to Future Brief on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. A defibrillator delivers up to 1,000 volts to a patient's heart. Inmates executed by electric chair typically receive about 2,000 volts. A typical lightning strike can transmit 100 million volts to a person. And yet people who get hit by lightning often survive, sometimes completely unscathed. How is that possible? Well, Marianne Cooper is Managing Director in the African Centres for Lightning Education and Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois. She joins me now. Marianne, how on earth do you study something like lightning strikes?
Well, my father loved lightning and swore that his children were not going to hide under the bed or in the closet when thunderstorms occurred. And so it was like the 4th of July every time we had the thunderstorm. And so I became interested in lightning and electrical injuries. And your question, where you or your statement that you made about electrocution and defibrillators and lightning is the most common mistake that people make about lightning, including attorneys, including physicians. They think they can take their garden variety familiarity with household current and then say electrical injuries, you know, just you can just magnify it. You can scale it up. That doesn't work with lightning. Lightning is very, very, the physics of lightning is incredibly different than technical or man-made electricity is. Other than the side effects, which both include brain injury and nerve injury, they're totally different. Electrical injuries, high voltage electrical injuries, it's a continuing current, even though it may be alternating current, it's a continuing exposure that eventually burns through the skin, then burns through the muscles, and you end up with major amputations. And it is definitely, no question, a burn injury. Lightning, on the other hand, the physics, the wave shape, the electrical and physics components of how you would describe it are so incredibly different. There's an incredibly fast rise time, a fast fall time. And that means that you're only exposed to a lightning energy for a microsecond, maybe 2 or 3 microseconds, as opposed to perhaps several seconds on an electrical line if you're holding on to an electrical source. As a result, I don't know if you cook or not, but if you microwave stuff, you know, before you pull the pan out of the microwave, you kind of tap it a little bit to see how hot it is, to see if you're going to need pads to bring it out, or if your fingers are going to tolerate the heat. We can draw you a line that says, depending on the temperature and your skin and the time, this is how long it's going to take for the skin to break down. But that's measurable time. When you're talking about lightning, it's so incredibly short that it doesn't have time to burn.
Wow. I want to say my understanding of electricity is well documented as being awful on this program. I do not understand it. But I presume an electrical strike on a person, that is, it is the flow of a large amount of electrons from one place to another.
Again, you said an electric strike. I think you mean lightning strike first.
Yeah.
So let's be
clear.
Yeah,
but I guess, I mean, is a lightning strike not an electrical strike?
It is a form of electricity. But again, you have to take into account the physics. And it's very short. And by the time the lightning gets to a person, only a tiny fraction goes through the person at the same time. Okay, lightning is not like a bullet. It's a field. It's like you had a fire hose that you were spraying at somebody. So at the same time that the energy is trying to go through the person, a large amount of energy is also going around the person and to ground, okay? By the time that energy gets to ground, the part of the lightning that's trying to get through the person gives up. I mean, there's a very small amount that goes through. It's like trying to pour a huge bucket of water through a straw. The person's the straw. Only a small amount will go through the straw. The vast majority goes around the outside.
Okay. So this is a bit of a segue because the original question I asked, I still want to know the answer to, and that is, how do you study something? Like, how do you know what an electrical strike does? Because are they not quite difficult to study because we don't know when lightning is going to strike?
That's a very good question. And yes, that's true. But I work with the Lightning Strike and Electric Shock Survivors group. So I've heard many, many stories over the years. With email, I have emails from people all over the world and phone calls from people all over the world for the last 30, 40 years telling me what they have afterwards. I may not be able to take care of the lightning injuries and do much after they have one, but I can work in prevention, which is what I do. I work at trying to prevent the lightning injuries, but I can also characterize what happens because I did the first study back in 1980. You know, my question as an emergency doc was, if somebody comes into me hit by lightning, what am I going to tell this guy's parents? Is he going to live? Is he going to die? What kind of complications is he going to have? Are they going to be permanent? How do you take care of them? Those kinds of things. So I did the first study that really looked at more than one or two people at a time. Lots of docs had reported, I had this case on Tuesday and this is what the guy had. But nobody looked at a population of 60, 80, 100 patients and said, how many have seizures? How many have cardiac arrest? What causes the death? So we can characterize it.
Okay, so let's do that in one second. But just remind me the numbers here. I mean, how common is this? How likely is one to be struck by lightning over the course of a lifetime?
Depends on where you are. If you're in Africa, it's far different than if you're in the United States. So I presume you're asking about the United States. The risk is very small, but it used to be a lot larger because people didn't know how to protect themselves. To prevent lightning injury, you need two things. One is you need safe places to go to. And we are blessed in this country that we're all within a few feet, usually a few seconds, of a safe place, a substantial building or a metal vehicle. The other thing you need to know is the behavior that you need to take to modify your risk. And the media are the ones that have worked on this, and the Lightning Safety Council too, but certainly the media are the ones that have gotten the safety information out over the past 25 years. And we have decreased the lightning deaths in the United States from around 60 or 70 a year in the late 90s down to under 20 a year now. So we've decreased by, you know, 60, 70%.
So let's talk about the injuries that we know people get and how they get them. What actually happens to your body when you get struck by lightning?
Now, that's what we don't know. The pathophysiology of what actually happens to the cells and all that. I can tell you that symptomatically what happens is very often the person is going to lose consciousness. They're going to have amnesia for a while. They're going to have many of the symptoms of brain injury, similar to the football players. Brain injuries, concussive, post-concussive types of things. And in the long term, they may have chronic pain. They may also have tinnitus or tinnitus, depending on how you want to say it, ringing in the ears and balance problems because of damage to the eighth cranial nerve. They may have some cardiac arrhythmias. Also, because lightning is an injury to the nervous system, they'll not only have the brain injury, but they'll have chronic pain because of damage to some of the nerves. And the third part of the nervous system is the sympathetic nervous system. So sympathetic nervous system controls your digestion, your blood pressure, your temperature control, things like that. So some people will complain that they never feel cold or they never feel hot. And that's because of the autonomic nervous system injury or instability.
Right. So, and I guess if you have electricity, you know, at such intense amounts passing through any sort of tissue or through your brain, there is a potential of any part of that nervous system, your brain, getting some sort of damage. So almost any neurological injury is theoretically possible, is it?
Absolutely. And the energy doesn't have to pass through your brain, because the vast majority of lightning injuries and lightning strikes to people are not direct strikes. Only 3 to 5% of the deaths are from a direct strike. The vast majority are from other mechanisms, including it hits a tree that you're standing under and part of it flashes across to you, or it hits a distance away and you're on the baseball field and it travels through the ground and gets to you. Another way is that anytime there's an electric field, it induces an opposite charge in anything close to it. So if you've got this charged thundercloud coming across the field that you're standing on, opposite charges are going to be induced in the telephone tower, the person standing there, a blade of grass, a cow. And so you get what's called upward leaders or upward streamers. Even if those don't connect with the lightning that's coming down, it's still a large amount of energy and can cause injury or death. Hmm. So you're talking about 95% of lightning injuries being indirect.
Okay. And so apart from those injuries that you talked about, there are some sort of telltale injuries, like the Lichtenberg figures. What are they?
Lichtenberg figures, yes, they are pathognomonic, which means if you got Lichtenberg figures, you had a lightning injury, period. You didn't have anything else, because it only occurs with lightning injuries. But they're rare, and they go away within a few hours to a few days.
So describe them for us visually. What is a Lichtenberg figure?
A Lichtenberg figure, just like if you look at lightning and you see all of the fingers coming out of it and all of the projections, that's what it looks like on the skin. It looks like a lightning strike because it has all of the fingers coming out of it. Or another way of looking at it, it's also called ferning. If you took a Boston fern and put it down on your skin, that's what it would look like. Okay. Now,
is this something to do with your capillaries or your blood vessels? I'm guessing because that's natural.
That's my theory. People have said it follows nerves. No, it doesn't follow nerve distributions. It follows blood vessels. No, it really doesn't. But because the current is going across your skin, it does induce, just as we were talking about, it induces a charge in those capillary muscle walls. The muscles contract. They squeeze a little bit of red blood cells and white blood cells out of the capillaries, and it looks like a bruise. It looks brownish, like a bruise might start with, to start with, kind of reddish brown. And then over a period of hours or days, it fades, and it fades through the colors of a bruise as well. So I think it's that. The other thing that goes with that is if you take a cross section through a Lichtenberg figure to see what it is it coalescence of the cells? Is it burning of the cells? Is it scarring? Is it, you know, whatever pathologists would look for? They don't see anything abnormal because there's normally red blood cells floating around and white blood cells floating around in your tissues trying to find bacteria to eat up and stuff like that. So that's my theory as to what a Lichtenberg figure is.
So all sorts of things can happen, but they're probably in keeping with what you would imagine with an electrical shock. But some people survive this incredible attack, even from a direct hit. Why is that? Why do some people walk away from a lightning strike? There are some people in the United States who claim to have been struck 6 of the 9 times. How does someone walk away from something like that?
Well, that's another good question. First of all, as we said, direct strikes make up a very small number. So the energy that's getting to a person is really not what journalists like to talk about. You know, there's so many millions of volts and that kind of stuff. So there's less energy. Secondly, it depends on what part of the cardiac cycle that it hits you, probably, because there are parts of your cardiac cycle, parts of your EKG, that show a time that is much more vulnerable. Very tiny amount of electricity, if it hits during that period, can cause a cardiac arrest. If it hits during the other times, they're not nearly as vulnerable. We don't know if that's the mechanism. It may be one of the mechanisms that causes death. Certainly, cardiac arrest is the only cause of death. Lightning doesn't kill you by any other ways.
Right.
And in developed countries, up to 90% of people who are injured by lightning survive. But the problem is they may have significant disabilities that keep them from going back to work. And that's what we're concerned about as well. Not just the deaths, but the disability.
Some of the victims of lightning strikes also report sort of phantom sensations, right?
That goes along with the nerve injury, just like phantom pain would go along with an amputation. First of all, the nerves that serve your hand, there's one cell that goes all the way from the tip of your finger all the way to your spinal cord. Now, there's lots of these cells, but that one cell is only one cell long, okay? Now, if you injure it at the wrist or the elbow or your armpit, your brain doesn't know where you injured it, okay? It just goes, well, that cell goes to the end of my index finger, so it must be my index finger that's hurting, okay? So it has to do with the way the body's electronics are connected. Okay.
Right.
As to where you're going to think you feel the pain. Now, it's real easy for us to think about sciatica. We all know sciatica is because the nerve is getting squeezed by a disc in the spine. It's the same kind of idea with phantom pain and pains otherwise. It's damage to the nerve. The brain interprets it perhaps incorrectly, but that's the way the brain interprets it. So maybe you seem to have pain in an area that you didn't expect.
You talked about these Lichtenberg figures?
Yes, sir.
Once that's gone, is there anything that actually is definitive that you can test and say someone's definitely been struck by lightning? Because I imagine for a doctor to try and understand if someone didn't know that they'd been struck by lightning, trying to understand what happened to them, why they suddenly just changed like this. If they don't have a burn, but they do have a brain injury, they don't have any of these Lichtenberg figures, is there anything permanent that's changed in the body that is a path or a biomarker for a lightning strike?
Unfortunately not. And oh my gosh, I wish we did have something like that because, you know, doctors are used to patients coming in. And unfortunately, you know, most people want to get back to work after they're injured. And then there's a group of people that a very small number that don't think they should go to work and they should be supported for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Guess which of those groups doctors see the most of? So when somebody comes in saying, you know, I'm not sleeping well, I can't concentrate, I have these strange pains, and it doesn't really fit any syndrome, it's real hard for some docs to believe that they're not just looking out for compensation.
Right.
And they may be honest, good, salt of the earth people and had a lightning injury, but there's no blood test that we can draw, no urine marker, no EKG or electrical test of any kind or x-ray that will say, yep, this was a lightning injury. Yep, automatic. Now, as a result of this article from The Atlantic back in February, a neurobiologist researcher, Kurt Gibbs from Morehead State University, wrote me and had a very interesting question. And he suggested that there are some biomarkers that are normally used for other forms of traumatic brain injury. And he suggested that those might be drawn for lightning patients as well. But to my knowledge, that's never been done. But I'm starting to push it, which is why I'm talking. But we have no research on that so far.
Right. Is there anything that we know makes someone more likely to get a lightning strike than others? Because clearly some people just, you know, if they're to be believed, are just lightning rods walking around, you know, because the chances of being struck, I don't know if you agree with this, once in your lifetime, the National Weather Service said in 2019 in the States, 1 in 15,300 is your statistics of likelihood of getting struck. And so getting struck twice is, you know, just theoretically unheard of, but lots of people get it. Do we know why someone might be more likely? I mean, it can't just be like they're taller. Why someone would be more likely to be struck by lightning?
First of all, there aren't lots of people. There are a few that have been hit multiple times, but I know several, and most of them are very reliable people. How many times do people win the lottery? It depends on how many tickets you buy, right? And it depends on if you're just the one that bought that ticket a couple of times. And so people win the lottery more than once. Same thing happens with lightning. If you are in a situation where you're exposed, so you're more in the southern United States than the northern United States, you're out in the middle of a field, you don't have any safe place to go to. Maybe you're out fishing on the water somewhere and it takes you too long to get in. Well, those are the kinds of things, if you can't get away from the thunderstorm, then you're more likely to be hit by lightning.
Right. We talked about the physical injuries, but we didn't talk about the mental ones. Do people, if they've got a bad hit from lightning, do they develop any sort of a mental trauma as a result of being hit? Do we see, you know, people getting depressed or anxious or you know, traumatized from these things?
Absolutely. No question about it. You know, PTSD used to be just for Vietnam vets, okay, and stuff like that. But it's been recognized that PTSD is much more common, and it goes along with a life threat. And you'd certainly say being hit by lightning is a life threat. So many people have PTSD after this. They're afraid of thunderstorms. They take shelter. They try to do as much as they can to avoid it, which is part of one of the criteria for PTSD is avoidance of the stimulus. Yeah, so that's quite common.
Okay. So before we finish, if you're in the middle of a lightning storm, don't stand near a tree. Find shelter. But to avoid those, you know, those streamers that come from the ground, the only thing you can do is just jump at the exact right time. That's a joke. What should you do in the case of a lightning storm?
Okay, first of all, know what the forecast is going to be and change your plans so that you're not outside when the thunderstorms are predicted. Secondly, if you do have to be outside, know where your safe shelters are and how long it's going to take you to get there. Or if you're responsible for the entire soccer team, how long it's going to take for them. Have a plan. So make the right decisions to start with. When thunder roars, go indoors. You can only hear thunder for about 10, 15 miles at the most. By the time you hear thunder, you're already in the danger zone for the next strike.
Okay.
So that's why we say when thunder roars, go indoors. It's the most reliable and easiest way you can teach three-year-olds.
Fantastic. Well, that's great. And really interesting speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time. As we say, that is Mary Ann Cooper, Managing Director in the African Centers for Lightning Education and Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois. Thanks, Mary Ann.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
That was interesting. We interviewed via Zoom, and she has loads of lightning stuff. I think she was even wearing a lightning t-shirt. She has lightning stuff all over, lightning photographs all over her studio where she did the interview. They're big into lightning in that family, which is very cool. I love meeting people like that. You know, we're like, well, when I grew up, when I was age 2 years old, my dad said, we're going to watch lightning for the rest of our lives. And that's how I'm a lightning researcher. And that's her story, which is really cool. I have never been struck by lightning, but I have. I've been witness to some incredible lightning storms. So in Argentina, we were in this real outback sort of swampy area, staying to do some wildlife trek or whatever. And oh my God, the lightning just kicked off. We were actually in the swimming pool going, isn't this cool? Not thinking so much about the risks, really, but kind of like going, look at this, we're in the middle of a thunderstorm and we're in a swimming pool. Now I don't think I'll do that, but incredible light show that was. Have you ever been close to being zapped? That was as close as I've been.
I found out through this research call, outrageously close to being zapped.
Oh, really?
So it was only about 6 months ago. I was coming home from my friend's house, and as we were at the door saying goodbye, it's about a 45-minute walk to my house. I could see in the distance coming over the Wicklow Mountains like a thunderstorm. I was like, oh, I better go because I want to get home. I'm going back into town. I want to get home before that comes. It was. You keep saying that louder. That's kind of what it was like. The whole way it was following me, getting closer and closer and closer and closer. And eventually I got to Harold's Cross and I was like, oh, no, I had to put my hood up and it was starting to rain. And I was coming around a corner, and in an instant, this is like at nighttime, in an instant, someone just turned the lights on. Like, I mean, totally turned the lights on for just like a split second. It was like, boom, daylight, instantly. And like a, then I'm like a very loud noise very soon after.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa, I'd never experienced that. And I told in the research call, I just happened to bring this up whilst asking a question of Marianne. And Marianne has obviously heard every lightning story there is. And I had the video on and I was telling her, oh, yeah, I once got hit by lightning. No reaction. She was like, oh, here, great. Here's this guy's lightning story. And when I mentioned the light switching on, her face, like her eyes just got really wide. And I was like, I think I was lucky. She was like, you were really lucky. She said, basically, the only people who say that thing, they saw the light switching on, are people who've been hit.
Wow.
So she was like, that basically must have hit.
Like, so it was like nighttime, then daytime.
Boom, instantly daytime for a second and then gone again. And well, less than a second.
That would have been so cool.
Yeah, yeah, it was cool. I thought it was cool at the time, but like you in the swimming pool, when you're in the light circle, oh, this is cool. That's probably when you're risking your own.
I know everyone says to go indoors, but if I was in a lightning storm, I would just, as I said to Marianne, I'd just jump. Just at the exact right time, I'd be fine.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah, because it was, yeah, because I had that time to jump. But yeah, apparently it would have. She was kind of suggesting, she didn't give me an exact distance, but she said it would have had to hit something close to me. And I was just coming around a brick wall corner, which I would say was maybe half a meter away from me.
Yeah, the backsplash
so
can
hit
kill
that.
You.
That and a backsplash can get you as well. Yeah,
did not know that. All right. We ask for your texts and tweets, your comments, your thoughts, your experiences. Share with us your humanity, and we will read out them at the end of the podcast. We were talking about junk food last week, and just high processed food, ultra processed food, and how bad it can be for you, and that even just a little bit of it just instantly disimproves your ability to function from a cognitive level. Paddy from Termin Feckin says, thought for the day, if your store has a health food section, what does that say about the rest of the food? I like that, buddy. I like that a lot. We're also talking about nightmares. We were speaking to a researcher last week, Michelle Carr, and she was talking to us about her work understanding nightmares and trying to help people deal with trauma and so on. It was a really interesting piece if you didn't hear it. But we got a message in from John Kiley, and he's a doctor. He says, hi, I enjoyed the show yesterday, but I do have a suggestion that you didn't mention in the section on dreams. As a respiratory sleep specialist, I often note that patients with obstructive sleep apnea have nightmares and dreams of struggling or fighting, etc. Now, that is a really good tie-in. So if you have sleep apnea, you're struggling to breathe because your airway is blocked. And actually, a lot of people, they wake up over and over and over again in the middle of the night because of the sleep apnea. And that if people are dreaming of struggling or fighting, that's a smoking gun, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that really says that our dreams and are really related to what's physically happening in our body. He says, these can be linked to what happens in an apnea when a whole body sympathetic nervous system stress occurs as a defense mechanism in order to respond to the occluded airway. Simply put, the body elicits the fight or flight response to open up the airway. Measurable raised adrenaline, stress hormones, ANP, blood pressure, tachycardia, all of these are recorded in apnea. And as such, can be experienced by OSA patients with apnea, sleep apnea. It is an increasingly common condition. It should have been mentioned by your interviewee. Keep up the good work. It wasn't an exhaustive interview. We didn't talk about everything, so no. I wouldn't blame the interviewee. I probably should have known that.
Yeah, well, also possibly should have brought up, because I definitely have anecdotally have friends who have sleep apnea who mentioned they get a lot of nightmares.
No way. Are those nightmares in? About like struggling, or are they about like clowns? Because well, if it's just clowns, then that would disprove the theory that there's any link.
Well, in order for it to be about clowns and be a nightmare, you'd have to be struggling with the clown, I'd imagine.
Yeah, maybe. All right, that's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McCovey producing, Molly Coleman on podcasts, and Hugo de Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious. Met a lot of people this week, by the way, just to finish off. A lot of people listening to the program say, oh, you listened to that? Oh, do you remember this episode? So everyone who said, oh, I listened to your program this week, I'm not going to name them all because it was quite a few. Thanks for listening. All right, see you next time.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sunday from midday. News Talk.
conversation that counts.